What's up, everybody? Welcome to the TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. I'm Thomas.
I'm Tyson.
I studied exercise physiology and competed in many various sports ranging from wrestling to ultra running. I use that knowledge to combine today's science with ancient wisdom to live an optimal lifestyle and to spread that information onto the masses.
I'm a lifelong weightlifter and I'm obsessed with health and wellness. My degree in biology, with an emphasis in neurobiology, physiology, and behavior, allows me to take a deep dive into the most current literature and bring that information to you.
Thank you for listening to the podcast. If you'd like to show your support, please rate and review on your favorite podcast provider, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or SoundCloud. Also, sign up on our website, tntwellnessandnutrition.com, for all of our up-to-date content.
Let's get this started. What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of TNT Wellness and Nutrition Podcast. This is episode 65, and today we're going to start a series on kind of weight loss techniques, fat loss techniques, and just ways that everybody can get in shape. Today we're going to be talking about cold therapy. So pretty much you can do this and not change your diet at all and eventually get leaner and healthier, honestly, just by doing this one thing. So it's going to be pretty cool, pretty interesting, I think. Good conversation. But first, do a quick check-in. So, Tom, how's your week been?
So this last week, I finally just got back into training. My off phase, my working in phase is over.
And that's because you ran an ultra and you took time off.
Yeah, I finished my last ultra. It was end of August, so I wanted to take 2 months off, let my body kind of heal, and now I'm ready to like get back in the gym, start training. And yeah, I got a lot of big goals for next year. So
did it feel good?
Yeah, definitely. It also felt really good to get back in the gym. I've been incredibly sore.
Really?
I'm shocked how sore I am.
Yeah.
But yeah.
You lose it so fast.
Yeah. Oh, I'm not really too worried about it. I'm pretty sure after 2-3 weeks, I'll be back to where I was before. I might lose a little bit fast, but it comes back really fast.
Did you train weights or just run?
So I'm doing both.
Okay.
So what I've been doing, and this is going to be like my little routine for now, is a 2 mile run when I get to the gym, just as a warm up. And then after that, right now I'm doing like really like slow training, a lot of negatives. And then after I do that for about a month, month and a half, just kind of sticking to that routine, then I'm going to start getting into more explosive type movements and stuff like that.
Okay.
But right now I'm not really focused on the HIIT style training, like the higher intensity stuff. It's just more, let me try to build up a little bit of muscle and really just kind of work on like my aerobic base.
Okay. Well, that's cool. It has to feel good to get back in the gym because, I mean, we've been training. We grew up in a gym.
Yeah, definitely.
So taking that much time off is hard.
Well, the biggest part that has helped is just with around diet. Because when I wasn't really training, I just didn't have that whole training mindset.
Yeah, that structure.
So with that, it's just kind of like I was a lot more relaxed with my diet. There was, you know, hey, do I want this? You know, why not? Normally my why not is, hey, I have this race coming up or I have this coming up.
Or I just had a good workout. Don't spoil it.
Yeah, something along those lines. Yeah, nothing to tell me why not. So I was eating a little bit worse than I should have, but whatever.
Hey, whatever happens.
Yeah, it wasn't that bad.
No, that's cool.
So what's new with you?
Oh, man, this week, so we had to postpone. People noticed we missed last week's podcast just because I initially wanted to do a podcast on, honestly, over-drinking water. So there's a huge narrative out there, especially with like health gurus and I don't know, people who claim to know stuff, even though no one really knows anything, but that you need to drink, you know, a gallon of water a day or 2 gallons of water a day.
Like
so
your body weight in ounces or like half your body weight in ounces, something crazy like that.
Yeah. So those are out there, right? That if you're going to do some sort of weight loss challenge, I have you drink 1 million pounds of water. So I wanted to kind of do a podcast just talking about how that's just BS. That's not true. And one of the areas I wanted to go into was hyponatremia, so low blood salt, and how that's actually a real problem. Like, that'll straight kill you. You know, you go into a hospital with a, I don't know, blood sodium of 120, good luck. You know what I mean? Like, you're done. So I kind of looked into the field, and there's a guy out there called Tim Noakes. And if you know anything about low carb or, I guess, running, right? You know him from running, I guess.
Yeah, he's like the authority when it comes to low carb athletes and running.
Yeah,
he's like, I mean, like pretty much he's like the authority when it comes to running.
Yeah. He knows his stuff for real. So he has a book called Waterlogged, and it's all about hydration when training and pretty much just water and salt. That's what the whole damn book's about. And so I started reading that a few weeks back, and I initially was like, okay, I'm going to get through this. I can read through a book like in like 2 days. You know what I mean? I can power read through shit nowadays, but this book legit took me weeks to get through. One, the dude is just, he's dumb smart. Like, the book is just a hard to read. It took me a long time to get through it. But one, I mean, two, his, what he was presenting was honestly almost the exact opposite of what I thought I knew about salt, you know, because I have read a little bit on salt. I read a book called The Salt Fix, and you know, I'm a pro salt guy. You're a pro salt guy.
Yeah, I do a little like half teaspoon of salt every morning,
Yeah, so do
and then
I.
salt my food. Pretty much any time I have an opportunity to take some salt in, I'm taking salt in.
Yep, me too. And his book didn't change what I'm gonna do at all, but he just kind of he has a different opinion that high salt isn't completely necessary for athletes in regards to performance, in regards to, you know, preventing cramps, all that type of stuff. So it made me, we had to push the podcast back. I didn't have enough time to kind of get my thoughts together. And honestly, I still don't. So this whole water podcast is going to have to be, I don't, God knows when. It's going to take me a while to kind of digest it. So I don't know. That whole book, it gave me more questions than answers. But in like the grand scheme of things, that's a good thing. Because by the time I'm done looking into all this, I'll know way more about hydration and salt than I ever did before. But sometimes you just want someone to give you the answers.
Yeah, no, I understand.
You know what I mean? So it's real hard. So I'm gonna have to go through the salt book again and just kind of see what studies he presented and then compare it to the studies presented in Waterlogged and honestly, I guess just find my own answers. And once I do, we'll have a podcast on water and hydration and all that type of stuff, and it'll be good.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to that. When he was talking about salt, was he just talking about sodium, or was he talking about pretty much all like electrolytes?
No, really focus just on salt. Really sodium chloride, that's pretty much
Okay,
it.
so not potassium, any of this. Okay.
Didn't talk about potassium a lot, didn't talk about magnesium at all, and mainly because the primary electrolyte in our blood is sodium. So the primary electrolyte inside our cells, intracellular, is potassium, but outside our cell is sodium, and it's just, we're salty people. There's a lot of salt in us, you know? So there's obviously enough salt in us to write a few books about it. So that's what he talked about. And yeah, it's just, I don't know, he's a real smart guy. And I don't know, maybe you feel this way. We're kind of, or at least I consider myself kind of a jack of all trades. Do you?
I mean, pretty much, because every time I'm like, oh, what book do I want to read next? It's always on something that I don't know anything about.
Okay.
So I like to be as well-rounded as I can.
See, you come to me, talk to me about training. I'm gonna know a little bit about training, and I can help you put a program together. I can put a program together in my sleep, okay? If
Yeah.
you're talking about food, I can talk to you about salt, sugar, fat, protein, whatever. That's really not a problem. But, or heart disease, cancer, I can tell you a little bit about all these things. But when I read books like this, I'm kind of jealous because this guy is like an expert on this stuff.
Yeah.
So even though I'm a jack of all trades with a lot of different things, I'm not an expert in anything. And it kind of makes me feel not dumb, but I was like, man, I wish I if I could spend 10 years looking up salt, oh, I would know just as much as this guy. But I can't, and I won't. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's kind of it's a trade-off. Either you know a little bit about most things, or these people know everything about this shit, you know?
But if you dedicate your life to learning about salt, it has to be important. It has to be. Or you wasted your entire life.
Yeah.
So you're kind of like forced to like find, I don't want to say false conclusions, but you're going to put a lot of weight into that. So I think it's personally better to be a jack of all trades. That way you kind of know how important everything is instead of thinking one thing is overly important.
You're referring to like, so there's a lady out there who her whole life is about studying oxalates. So to her, what is everything caused by?
Oh, every single thing that goes wrong in your life, you got a flat tire, it's oxalates.
It's
Everything,
oxalates. It's
yes.
oxalates. And there's guys out there who all they study is like omega sixes.
Yeah.
So like everything's So I get that, and that's true. And that's honestly me and you being a jack of all trades, we can see that.
Yeah, oh, for sure.
You can spot it a mile away. Yeah. So I don't know. It's a blessing and a curse doing the things, or at least the way I do it. It's kind of whatever. I don't know if I would change it, but sometimes I get around these people who are so smart. And I'm like, oh, I'm a dummy.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know about this shit. So that's pretty much, yeah, that's all that happened with me this week. And it's the reason we didn't have a podcast last week. I just had to get all my stuff together. But
Well,
we.
that and this topic was a little bit more complicated I don't know, complicated, but there's just a lot more to this topic than we originally thought.
Oh, very true. Yeah, very true. So, yeah, I guess that's a good time to kind of get into this week's podcast. We're going to be talking about, like, officially it's called adaptive thermogenesis. Well, really all it is just cold exposure. So I take cold showers, Tom takes cold showers, and there is a metabolic effect to it, a metabolic benefit, and we're going to go through all that, obviously, in the next, like, hour, but it's just hard, for one. That's probably the main benefit in my eyes is, you know, I think we all need to do kind of hard shit. Everyone's kind of going through life sliding by easy. Oh, when I was reading that book, Waterlogged, all it talks about is ultra running and marathon runnings. You know what book I reread or re-listened to when I was driving?
The Goggins one?
The Goggins book, yeah. Okay. So I'm like super aggressive lately. So it was like, I just felt like it was appropriate to reread the David Goggins book, Can't Hurt Me, while I was reading the other book, Waterlogged, about running. But yeah, so let's just get into it. So the main benefit of a cold exposure, well, actually, maybe I shouldn't word as a main fan, but one of the benefits revolves around brown fat. And brown fat's different because it's really metabolically active, not similar to white fat, which is mainly for like storage and nutrient stuff like that. So in brown adipose tissue, they're very mitochondria dense. So the mitochondria release chemical energy in the form of heat by means of uncoupling of the oxidative phosphorylation. So pretty much, you can go back to the CoQ10 episode. Our body has an electron transport chain, and at the end of it, you have pretty much a machine, ATP synthase, that produces ATP. And that's what we want our mitochondria to do. We want our mitochondria to produce ATP. That's what our cells use for energy. But in certain situations and in certain cells, like brown adipose tissue, instead, they have electron transport chains, you know, they have mitochondria, but they don't, the end product isn't ATP. We don't need them to produce ATP. We have them to produce heat. So they have these uncoupling proteins, specifically uncoupling protein 1, which is very unique, or it's actually exclusively found in brown fat, uncoupling protein 1. And they uncouple that electron transport chain, and instead of producing ATP, they produce heat. And that's really the main separator for brown fat. And as we get fatter, which fatter is not really a politically correct term, huh?
More fat? I mean, I don't know.
Obese? I don't know. I guess I need to find a more like PC word for these things. But as we accumulate more body fat, that's all I should say. We actually have less and less brown fat. And there's a study. I'm going to link all these studies on the website like I always do. But it was pretty much linear. So the higher your BMI, the less brown fat you have. And that's not a good thing. Brown fat is metabolically active. Brown fat is actually very healthy to have on our bodies. So the leaner you are, more than likely you're going to have more brown fat. And the heavier you are, the less brown fat you're going to have. So they did a study where they exposed these people to 59 degrees Fahrenheit for 60 minutes. Which, mind you, 59 degrees is not that cold. We both live in California, and 59 degrees happens here all the time.
Well, I guess it depends on what you're wearing for 59 degrees.
Is it?
Like, if you're, like, butt-ass naked in 59 degrees, I would think that's kind of cold.
Okay, sure. I don't know why in my brain it doesn't
look cold. And, like, if you're not in the sun, 59 degrees is kind of cold. But if you're wearing jeans and a t-shirt and you're out in the sun, 59 degrees is, it's perfect. It's
okay. Kind of warm. Yeah. So they put these people in 59 degrees for 60 minutes. And for the lean group, the average heat production increased by 17%. And for the overweight group, the increase was only 6.4%. So their skin temperatures were the same. So it's not like the lean group got any colder. Like the fat from these obese people didn't like insulate them better. It just shows that the obese people had less brown adipose tissue in them. And
that's over 2.5 times. That's almost 3 times as much.
Huge difference.
Yeah, that's a really big, that's a significant difference.
Yeah, significant difference for sure. Like when we talk about like statistically significant differences, that's it. You know what I mean? We're not talking about a 0.2 increase, you know?
Yeah.
But there are ways to increase the amount of brown fat we have.
Yeah, and that's pretty much what the point of this conversation is today, is just pretty much how you can switch white fat into brown fat. So brown adipose tissue, or brown fat, is primarily found like in your supraclavicular area. That's like right above your neck, like right around your neck. And then also kind of around your spine and your upper chest. So in infants, it's really important, because that's where all your vital organs are in that area. So in infants, like, you have very little means of producing body heat, so you need this brown adipose tissue to produce more body heat to keep you alive.
Yeah.
And that's basically what's going on with adults, too, is, hey, if you're exposed to cold more and more, you need something to keep your vital organs warm. And that's where switching that white adipose tissue into brown fat is a good idea.
Yeah, very good idea.
So it's all about regulating body temperature. And unfortunately, as we age, we get less and less brown adipose tissue.
Yeah.
And it's brown because it has more mitochondria, increased density of mitochondria. And it looks completely different than white adipose tissue. White adipose tissue is really mostly found around your gut. Some, if you're a woman, maybe more around your like butt and thighs. Yeah. You know, kind of just...
If you're chubby, it's everywhere.
You know where it's at. It's visible.
You know where it's at, yeah. 100%. But yeah, brown adipose tissue looks nothing like that. Like, it honestly resembles muscle more than it resembles fat. Like, it's honestly a completely different tissue.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And that's all because of mitochondria. Pretty much, I feel like we say it's all about the mitochondria in every podcast.
Every podcast. It's true, though. Yeah. It really is.
So one of the ways to turn your like white fat into brown fat is by activating a hormone called adiponectin. Adiponectin is a hormone that signals to your body to transport glucose to muscles and to break down white fat for fuel. So when you're exposed to cold, you need to produce more body heat. Where that's really going to be happening is in your muscles. So your muscles now have more fuel in order to contract and create more body heat. So think of shivering. Yep. Shivering is like an extreme example of this. But even if you're not creating so much body heat in the form of like shivering, you're still doing little bits of heat production in your muscles. That's where all of the majority of your body heat is being produced in, is your muscles.
Yeah, you don't have to be like teeth clattering cold for this to be happening. But if you're just walking around on a semi-chill day, your muscles are going to be burning more fuel for heat.
Yeah, one thing we both talked about this beforehand is like, what happens if you take a cold shower or if you jump in a pool?
You
tense up like into a nice little ball. You like flex all your muscles. So maybe if you're not shivering, you're not flexing that hard, but you're still contracting your muscles to produce more body heat.
Yeah.
So there's two studies that we're going to link, but basically I'm just going to summarize them. One just says that cold exposure increases adiponectin. That's that hormone that I talked about earlier. And then another study just shows that adiponectin increases fatty acid oxidation. That just means that you're burning white fat for fuel.
Yeah, that's exactly. And that's what you want to do. That's what we all want to get better at. We all want to burn more fat for fuel, and especially burn more fat for fuel efficiently, right? That's obviously one of the main benefits of the keto diet, is you're able to burn body fat for fuel, you know? And we're obviously both pro-keto around here, you know? But there are studies literally showing an increase in metabolism based on cold exposure. So this study is called Functional Brown Adipose Tissue in Healthy Adults. And it's funny, I was so sick of writing brown adipose tissue. You're going to see in these notes, I just started labeling BAT, B-A-T. Yeah. Oh my God, I've been so sick of writing this shit 100 times. But in this study, the subjects were wearing light clothing and spent 2 hours in a room that had a temperature of about 65 degrees. Now, again, I don't think that's that cold, but maybe I'm just mistaken because my ass is in a like a little apartment all damn day.
I mean, 65 sounds nice to me.
It sounds nice to me, too.
It's not cold, it's not hot, it's just, yeah, it's pleasant.
Pleasant, yeah, exactly. So this study tracked a sugar, and they used a PET scan. They used a radio-labeled sugar, but the actual predominant substrate used by brown adipose tissue is fatty acids, so they kind of extrapolated how much fat this tissue could burn if brown adipose tissue was activated for over a year. And so they just picked up one of their subjects, and their subject had a brown adipose tissue weight of 63 grams. And their rate of glucose uptake was 12.2 micromolars per 100 grams per minute during activation of brown adipose tissue. And only approximately 10% of the total metabolism of brown adipose tissue is derived from glucose. The other 90% is from fatty acids, which makes perfect sense. Our body wants to use fat for fuel.
We have so much of it laying around. Even the leanest individuals do.
Yes, has pounds of fat, thousands and thousands of calories, right? So, if the brown adipose tissue in this example were fully activated, it would burn an amount of energy equivalent to approximately 4.1 kilograms of adipose tissue over the course of a year. And I did a little math, so 4.1 kilograms is over 9 pounds. And 9 pounds of fat is about 31,500 calories. And that's based on the approximation of each pound of fat is 3,500 calories. And you can argue that a little bit if you want. This is just kind of an approximation. But just think that this cold exposure gave these people 31,000 calories of wiggle room in the course of a year.
That's a lot.
That's a lot, right? And just think, like, this is literally a way your body can waste calories. And it's another benefit of the keto diet. It gives your body a way to waste calories. You can breathe out ketones. You can pee out ketones. You don't have to use all ketones for fuel. So this is one of the reasons why, like, calories in, calories out doesn't account for stuff like this, and it's dumb. Like, you just think, if you're out there, you're a girl, you weigh 120 pounds, and even 120 pounds for 10 years. Have you weighed the same exact calories for 10 years?
Probably not.
Probably not, right? And this is what we're talking about. When you're in a, like, metabolically active state, or healthy state, I should say, and your body is burning fat for fuel, you give your body ways to kind of regulate and kind of just balance out. So an extra 30,000 calories a year, which is a crazy amount, just on cold exposure.
Well, when you're counting, I mean, you could kind of accurately calculate calories in, but calories out, I don't know how you really calculate that. So, like, at the end of the day, do you be like, okay, I was in an 85-degree room for this amount of time. I was in a 50-degree room for this amount of time. I was in this temperature room. I was sitting down. I was standing up.
And you need to check your breath the entire day.
You have to be checking all these different things to have some sort of...
Check, like, your urine?
Yeah, like how much energy were you using on body temperature?
Yeah.
There's no way to calculate
that. There's no way to calculate it. Or at least no realistic way, you know, unless you want to be a lab rat, you know?
Yeah, so we're just talking about how many calories you can possibly be burning from body temperature. And there's nobody that's calculating that.
Nobody's calculating that at all. So... just that cold exposure, it really gives you an edge. It really does. But yeah, as we mentioned earlier, it's not just the activation of brown adipose tissue, and it's not just the conversion of white adipose tissue to brown adipose tissue. It's actually our muscles are activated as well for this cold therapy. And this study is called "The Human Skeletal Muscle Mitochondrial Uncoupling is Associated with Cold-Induced Adaptive Thermogenesis." And this is a quote. "So this study for the first time shows that in humans, skeletal muscle has intrinsic capacity for cold-induced adaptive thermogenesis via mitochondrial uncoupling under physiological conditions." Shit, these things are so wordy sometimes. All that means is when you're cold, your muscles have the capacity to uncouple, and instead of producing ATP, they produce heat. And that's a way our body can waste calories.
Yeah, because ATP is just an energy, like, unit. Another, like, form of energy is just heat. So you have two options there. Mm-hmm. Either just produce heat or produce a form of energy.
Yeah, and that's what's going on. Yeah, I just ate post-workout. I mean, God, it's been a long time now. I had 2,300 calories, 220 grams of protein in one meal. You know what I'm doing right now?
I'm sweating.
Okay, you know what I mean? Like, my body did not want all that protein. I gave it to it, though, and now I'm sweating. It's the way it happens. So in this study, they just had mild cold exposure, and it significantly increased 24-hour energy expenditure by 2.8%. So this was 11 people. They were in 60 degrees Fahrenheit for 82 hours, which is actually kind of a long time. But if you just kind of extrapolate that data, 3% of 3,000 is 90 calories a day of just extra energy. And that's not a bad thing.
No, not at all.
Like, everyone wants to increase their metabolism. So if you can just expose yourself to some cold temperatures, either via shower or via outside, and boost your metabolism, you definitely should.
So another benefit of cold exposure is decreased blood sugar. So again, the adiponectin that I was talking about earlier, it causes your body to use up some of that extra blood glucose. So your muscles have some sort of energy to use as fuel. So that's one benefit. Low blood glucose means low insulin. Low insulin means increased fat oxidation. So that low blood glucose benefit, increased fat oxidation, always a benefit if you're trying to be burning fat.
For sure.
So here's a study that was done in functional brown adipose tissue in healthy adults. We found that cold-induced glucose uptake was increased by a factor of 15 in paracervical and let me say that again.
Oh, I read that word so many times. It's a hard word.
Well, it was the cervical and the clavicular back-to-back. Yeah, it's a tongue twister because they look so similar.
Yeah.
So, we found that cold-induced glucose uptake was increased by a factor of 15 in paracervical and supraclavicular adipose tissue. I'm going to pat myself on the back for getting through that
good
one.
Good job.
That was hard.
Uh-huh.
So basically what that's saying is the paracervical is around your neck. The supraclavicular is right above your neck. That's right above your clavicle, so just around your neck. That's where all the brown adipose tissue is. That's why it was increased by such a big factor.
Factor of 15.
15 is gigantic.
Huge.
That means 15 times more.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, brown adipose tissue is burning up a ton of glucose.
Yeah.
So white adipose tissue also uptakes more glucose by about 4 times as much when it's exposed to cold.
And that's cool too.
Oh, it's definitely.
Like, it's not a bad thing.
The more metabolically active tissue there is always a good thing.
Always a good thing. Yeah,
if it's metabolically active, that means it's using calories and not storing them.
Yeah. Actually, something that came up in these studies, I didn't know this, is brown adipose tissue can actually cause false positive for PET scans. Because PET scans, they honestly track sugar. Because guess what loves sugar? Cancer. Cancer loves sugar. So that's what PET scans really do. You know, they track what tissues are really burning through sugar. And back in the day, they were like, what's all this shit causing false positives around their neck? They're thinking they have, like, thyroid cancer, when really it was just brown adipose tissue.
Oh, I did not know that.
That's interesting, right?
Mm-hmm. So if you were really healthy and you, let's say you were doing, like, cold water plunges every single morning, you're a swimmer, something like that.
Arctic.
So, like, you're really doing a lot of that. If you go in for a PET scan, they might think you have, like, a thyroid tumor.
Yeah, for sure. That's happened.
Damn.
Yeah, and actually, they show, like, if you're ever interested in this, I don't know who is, but there's, I'll link the studies, of course, but they have images, like, obviously, the scans, and they light up like Christmas trees. Like, super bright, just like tumor would. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess it makes sense.
Yeah, it does. Mm-hmm.
Especially when you're not used to probably scanning healthy people.
Yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you're, like, 99% of them are not going to be like that.
And they're not going to have that brown adipose tissue. Yeah, exactly.
All right, so another study and another benefit of cold exposure. This one comes in antioxidant production. So our bodies produce more antioxidants in the form of glutathione, superoxide dismutase, and catalase. So this study compared cold water swimmers to warm water swimmers. Basically what had happened was during wintertime, participants either swam indoors in like a heated pool or they were swimming outside in like a previous frozen lake. So they were swimming in temperatures from like 1 to 5 degrees Celsius. So that's like 32 to 40 degrees Fahrenheit. That's really cool. Yeah. I'm not about to be doing that.
Yeah, that's cool.
They were only going for 5 to 10 minutes. That's 5 to 10 minutes too long, in my opinion. But good on them.
Yeah.
So the cold water swimmers had increased glutathione. So here are the 3 markers that they were using for antioxidant production. They were actually enzymes that they were tracking. So glutathione peroxidase, superoxide dismutase, and catalase. All 3 of those were increased, especially the superoxide dismutase and the catalase. They were all much higher for the cold water swimmers versus the control group.
Yeah, that's such a huge benefit. Huge benefit.
So you can increase your immune system, your antioxidant production, just by going out in the cold, but just by swimming, taking a cold shower, doing anything like that.
Yeah.
You can make yourself healthier and more resistance to some sort of oxidative stress.
Yep. And this was only, you can say, 5 to 10 minutes. These people weren't out there all day. This doesn't have to be a huge time commitment. You know, you don't have to go for a 5-hour walk in the damn Arctic. You know what I mean? So, and talking about immune system support, like, there have been studies showing that cold exposure will strengthen your immune system, not just increase your antioxidant capacity. And even though that's a huge benefit, as one of the benefits, I think people seem to not think that we have our own antioxidants, like, within us. Like, everyone always thinks, like, you have to eat some sort of, like, green or red smoothie to get antioxidants.
You have to get your blueberries.
Yeah. Like, our body makes our own, and the ones we make are killer. Like, they do their job great. You know what I'm saying? So if there's ways out there that we can increase our own antioxidants, that's exactly what we should do. We shouldn't rely on some pill or some smoothie to get antioxidants, you know?
Well, kind of true, but kind of not. Because there's things that we can do to, like, increase our own endogenous antioxidant production that are not a good thing.
Like what?
Smoking cigarettes.
Oh, okay. Well, we don't want to do that. That's just, like, an extra stress.
So I'm just saying, like, just because something increases your antioxidant production, it should be a benefit, but there are also times where it's not a benefit.
Yeah, it's just like
it depends on the stressor.
Yeah, the stressor, yeah.
I mean, like, the examples that we're using, it's, you know, really short terms of cold exposure. So in those times, it's good. Like, you know, 5 to 10 minutes, it's benefit.
Mm-hmm.
if it was 50 hours in, like, you know, a frozen lake, probably not a good thing because you're probably going to die. So,
yeah, I don't care how much glutathione you're producing, right?
Yeah.
If your glutathione is going through the roof, it's going to be in popsicle.
Oh, you're all brown adipose tissue, but it's still not enough.
Yeah, it's not enough. Yeah, that's funny. So so this is actually a report or a paper on the immune system benefits of cold exposure. So it's called Scientific Evidence-Based Effects of Hydrotherapy on Various Systems of the Body. So it's pretty much ways cold water helps the immune system. And it says that daily brief cold stress can increase both numbers and activity of white blood cells, specifically peripheral cytotoxic T lymphocytes and NK cells. And so the long-term effects of cold stress repeated daily over the period of 5 days to 6 weeks increase plasma levels of tumor necrosis factor gamma, IL-2 and IL-6. That symbol's gamma, right?
It's alpha.
Is it alpha? Fuck, what does gamma look like? Oh, gamma looks like a G, huh?
Yeah.
Hey, I'm not... What is this, Greek? What is this bullshit? I don't know Greek, all right? I'm a damn American. But IL-2, tumor necrosis factor alpha, IL-2, and IL-6. So what this is possible, what they're saying is that brief cold water stress over many months could enhance anti-tumor immunity and improve non-lymphoid cancer survival rates. Which is like... Do you need another reason to take a cold shower?
So, anti-tumor and anti-cancer, that both seems pretty good to me.
Yeah, come on, man. Like,
as well as, you know, white blood cells. I can't believe you said NK cells and not natural killer cells.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, that's like my favorite type of cell. Like, the natural killer cell is sounds so badass.
Hey, I'm trying to abbreviate everything in these damn notes, all right? I'm sick of writing all this shit. But yeah, no, that's true. And there have been some studies on the effects of cold shower and whether people like call in sick to work or not. So this is a study called The Effect of Cold Showering on Health and Work, a randomized controlled trial. So taking cold showers did reduce sick calls. So 79% of the participants in the intervention group completed the 30 consecutive days of protocol, and a negative binomial regression model showed a 29% reduction in sickness absence for the hot to cold shower regimen compared to the control group. So that's about a 30% reduction in sick calls for the people who actually did take cold showers for 30 days. And this didn't change their diet. This didn't change if they were working out. They just said, hey, take a cold shower in the morning. That was the intervention.
Okay. So this was actually an intervention. It wasn't like, oh, hey, people that can't afford to have hot water went to work more often because they fucking have to because they're broke.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's
no economic part of this. Okay.
I mean, it fucking might have been. But yeah, it's just, there. I mean, take this study as you will, maybe with a grain of salt. But there is some proof out there that taking cold showers really will help you. And honestly, like, I couldn't tell you the last time I've been sick. And I take cold showers every day.
The last two times I've been sick were on the last two Super Bowls.
Really? You think it's just from the party?
No, it was like I was sick Super Bowl Sunday the last 2 years. And those are the last two times I've been sick.
That's funny.
And the only reason I remember that is because, like, last time I was sick on the Super Bowl Sunday, mm-hmm. I was like, damn, it's been a long time since I was sick. I was like, you know what? I didn't do anything for the Super Bowl last year. I was like, oh, yeah, that's because I was sick.
I was sick then, too.
And I was like, yeah, that must have been the last time.
It's your new ritual, I guess.
I don't know what it is about early February.
That gets you, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I partly attribute me not getting sick to my diet, to the cold showers, and just a mindset. I refuse to get sick. I always say I'm too strong to get sick. I said bugs hop on me and then they bounce right off. They're like, fuck that. They don't want this fight. So
that's they know what they think. Can't win.
They know they can't win. They give up. Yeah, exactly.
All right. So we talked about how cold thermogenesis is great for your immune system, how it's great for turning white fat into brown fat and just reducing fat overall. Another area that we're going to talk about, we'll talk about that in another podcast, is how it decreases inflammation. We're going to get into the benefits of decreased inflammation. So for right now, just know that it decreases inflammation.
Yeah, that is such a big topic that it definitely deserves a whole other episode. I mean, because people, how many people throw around the term inflammation?
Oh, it's everywhere.
How many people really know what the shit inflammation is?
You know, what's funny is, like, I was just kind of thinking of, like, how would you really explain, like, inflammation to somebody? And I was just thinking, like, it's your body is in a state of pretty much repair.
Well, yeah.
That's pretty much what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So whether you want your body to be in that state of repair or not, there's a lot of nuance to it.
There's definitely a lot of nuance to it. And, yeah, exactly. What injury is prompting that repair process, yeah. right? And are you continually exposing yourself to that injury? You know what I mean? Because people say sugar is inflammatory, which it is. So, but yeah, I don't want to go into it now because it's way too big of a podcast, but we're going to definitely break that down eventually. And
well, I think things that are pro-inflammatory basically just means that it's causing damage to your body.
Yeah.
And that's what they're...
And your body has to repair it.
Yeah. That's kind of like the...
The gist.
Like the kindergartner version of that.
100%. Yeah.
So let's just talk about icing and exercise. So that's one of the major areas that people do this at.
Yeah.
So one of the pros for it is adiponectin. It signals a shuttle for glucose. It shuttles glucose into your muscles. So that's a way to increase muscle growth and recovery. It's a really good thing. It also can decrease swelling. So that's really a benefit too. Poor blood flow through the area. That means less oxygen and nutrients delivered to that area. Not something we want in some damaged tissue.
You know what? Now I'm just actually putting this together right now. As far as your muscles getting more glucose and growing, that's a good thing, right? Because glucose can be used as fuel. So the main trigger for muscle protein synthesis, well, you can work out and that'll trigger it as well. But from the diet standpoint, is 3 grams of leucine. That's a trigger our body uses. That's an amino acid. It's a branched chain amino acid our body uses to kind of signal to our body that, hey, there's a lot of protein around. Feel free to start building muscle. That's what it is. 3 grams of leucine triggers muscle protein synthesis. But there's a limit to it. So after about 30 minutes, muscle protein synthesis will actually decrease. It'll stop, even though the amount of amino acids in our blood supply are still elevated, right? So amino acids aren't being used. What they speculate is that it's literally muscle protein synthesis is so metabolically demanding, the amount of ATP in the cell can't keep up with the muscle protein synthesis, right? So with more glucose in our cell, our muscles can produce more ATP and maybe theoretically produce more muscle protein synthesis.
Okay, that makes sense.
You follow that logic? Yeah. I follow that logic too. I like that idea. And that's actually one of the reasons, I think I brought that up in the magnesium podcast, one of the reasons I supplement with magnesium post-workout is every ATP in our body is attached to a magnesium molecule. So if ATP is a limiting factor in muscle protein synthesis, I don't want it to be a magnesium deficiency.
Okay.
So it's another reason why I take magnesium post-workout as well, along with the other million benefits magnesium has. Sorry, I just had to talk about that.
Would CoQ10 play a role in that as well?
I don't know. Okay. I don't know if it's a limiting factor or not.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, and not for, it ain't for me, because you know what I post-workout every day?
Yeah, heart.
Beef heart, baby. Yeah, loaded with CoQ10. Yeah.
All right, so we got a little sidetrack right there.
Yeah.
All right, so more glucose in the muscles, decreased swelling, some pain relief. Everybody realizes that. And due to that decreased swelling and that pain relief, you're getting increased mobility, which is a good thing. You want increased mobility. That's going to increase blood flow through the area. So that means... increased blood flow basically just means more good things getting in and the bad things getting out. So some cons to that. So cons to like icing post-exercise. Decreased inflammation is not necessarily a good thing. So what I mean by that is if you have a basketball game tonight and you have a basketball game tomorrow night, that's why you always see like Steph Curry after he's done for the game. He's got some ice on his knees or somebody's got some ice on their shoulders because they need that inflammation to go away. So they can train again the very next day and compete again.
Yeah.
But if you're talking about somebody that's not going to compete for months at a time or like a week or two later, you don't really want to decrease that inflammation. Inflammation is a state of healing and repair. So if you're getting rid of some of that inflammation, that means you're getting less adaptation to that exercise. You're getting less repairs from it.
Yeah.
So decreasing that inflammation is not always a good thing. That's why most people are going to say don't take some sort of Tylenol or one of those anti-inflammatory drugs.
Yeah.
Don't take those post-exercise.
Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, NASAIDs or whatever. Totally. I think I just said like 4 random letters.
I don't know if you had them right. You had the letters right. I just don't know if they're in that right order. That's why I didn't say it. NSAIDs or something like that.
Yeah, I don't think they were in the right
order. Yeah, you don't want to be decreasing inflammation post-exercise.
Because honestly, you just worked out. In the grand scheme of things, working out just causes inflammation. That's the benefit. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And then it's your body's response to that inflammation that causes the actual growth. No one grows when they work out. No one grows when they're playing basketball. You grow in the recovery phase.
Yeah, when I walk in the gym, I feel like a giant. And when I walk out, like a baby will beat me up.
Yeah.
Like that's kind of how I feel. Like, so working out doesn't make you stronger.
It doesn't. It's your response to it that does, yeah. So there is a little nuance to the whole icing around your workout. Just, I think the best recommendation is do what works for you. Personally, I take cold showers directly after I work out. Well, maybe not true. I train. I always do some sort of cardio post-workout. And I think of that almost like a hot therapy because I just break a sweat. And sometimes I'll wear a hoodie while I train. I always train in a beanie, actually, so I'm always kind of sweating a lot. And then after that, maybe 30 minutes to an hour of cardio, I do a cold shower. And for me, it works. For me, I like it. I don't necessarily think about benefits for training. I don't think of benefits for muscle growth. I really do it because it's uncomfortable. And I think more people need to do things that are uncomfortable.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah. So yeah, in summary, I think cold showers are great. You know, I think cold exposure is awesome. It's a great way to increase your metabolism. It's a great way to burn more calories throughout the day, literally just sitting still. You don't have to work out more. You don't have to change your diet, even though I recommend you should do both of those things, but you don't have to. Take a cold shower in the morning. Your immune system is going to be increased. You're going to have more antioxidants. You're going to recover better. You're going to, honestly, be leaner. You're going to be burning more calories just sitting still. Like, why not? What's the con here?
I mean, other than it's uncomfortable, there really isn't one.
Yeah.
Yeah, like, okay, so...
And I would argue that's the biggest pro.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it has so many benefits. You're going to be healthier, leaner, you're less sick, like, I mean, less inflamed. Like, yeah, there's a ton of benefits to it overall.
Yeah.
So the tip of the week this week is just going to be about some ways that you can do some cold exposure. So what we've been talking about are cold showers. So ideally, you want these to be between 2 to 5 minutes. I mean, honestly, it's not like if you only do it for a minute 59 instead of 2 minutes, you're getting zero benefits. It's all on a spectrum. But just know, like, two minutes minimum, five maximum. I wouldn't be taking, like, a 45-minute cold shower. That just seems miserable.
Yeah, it's actually funny you said that. Recently, I forget the mechanism. I think, it was autophagy. Somebody was talking about autophagy. And I was telling her, you know, people, I guess what we talked about, high insulin, your body is only burning sugar, your body's not burning fat. Low insulin, your body's only burning fat, not sugar. And I was kind of explaining to her that, you know, these things aren't like an on-off switch in our body. They're more kind of like a dimmer switch.
Yeah.
Nothing's really ever 100% this way or 0% that way. You know, it's always going to be, you want it definitely other ways, you know, like 20-80 sometimes for various hormones. But just like with this, it's not going to be like at 159, it's zero. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, it's a dimmer switch. And I guess to go through my routine in a cold shower, I've developed this. It probably only works if you're, like, super white like me. But I do my normal shit in the shower, like, you know, get the soap, do your thing. And you'd be surprised how fast you can soap up and soap down when the water's cold. I mean, you can do this shit in, like, 30 seconds flat. But the way I personally stay in the cold shower longer is whatever muscle group I train that day, I sit in the shower for 1 minute on that muscle. So let's say I train, like today I train legs. So for 1 minute, I let the cold shower just rest on my quad and I count to 60 in my head. And then I do the other leg, I count for 60 in my head. So at least I'm in the shower for, you know, that 3 to 5 minute range, trying to kind of stay in there as long as I can comfortably.
Yeah, that's a really good technique if that works. Another way you can do it too is to switch between cold and hot. So you do like 20 seconds cold, 10 seconds warm, 20 seconds cold, 10 seconds warm. Personally, I don't do that.
Seems like a lot of work.
It seems like a lot of work, and it just seems, I don't know, just kind of like, it seems like it's more miserable.
Yeah, because you get hit with cold every time.
Yeah, you're getting that cold exposure every 30 seconds instead of just that one time and you can adapt to it.
Oh yeah, I was going to say, it only works because I'm so white. It's because I can literally see, like, the muscle group I'm, like, the cold water's on. It starts to turn red. I can notice it. And then I'm like, okay, this is long enough. You know what I'm saying? Then I move on. I can actually visually see it. If you're a little bit darker, you probably wouldn't be able to notice.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. Yeah. I thought you were going to say white. I'm better with cold.
Yeah.
I don't know
what you're really like. Yeah, I wanted to make sure I got that out there.
So another thing that's pretty much right there with cold showers is either a cold bath or even an ice bath. I mean, an ice bath, that seems you have to have some sort of tools to do that. You're not probably going to be filling up a normal bathtub with ice. That's a shit ton of ice.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's any way to do like some sort of cold soak. If you're going to do an ice bath that's going to be that cold, I mean, you pretty much just need 30 seconds. 30 seconds is pretty much the minimum. You can even do 30 seconds in, take a minute out, 30 seconds back in, try to get that up to 2 minutes if you want to.
You know, the big strongmen out there, I know, like Brian Shaw and the what's his name? Not the Mountain?
The Mountain,
yeah. The Mountain, yeah. What they do, they actually have, like, cold tubs, like a hot tub, but the opposite. It's just cold as shit. And they have them next to each other, hot tub and a cold tub, and they just bounce between the two. I'm actually super jealous of that. Because no one's going to buy, I don't know, 100 bags of ice every day. But you have a tub that's set at 30 degrees, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Another way to do that is if you live somewhere cold, is you just have a hot tub outside, and you just don't heat it during the winter time.
It just gets cold.
And now you just have a cold tub.
That's cool. That's true.
So we don't get a benefit that from where we live, but...
It never gets that cold.
If you live up in, like, Montana, Wyoming, somewhere like that, Minnesota... Well, maybe Minnesota might be too cold. If you live somewhere like that, yeah, you have that built-in ice bath.
Yeah.
I wish I had something like that.
Me too.
Another thing is there's an ice vest, and there's other, like, ice belts and stuff like that. And the way to think of that is just, like, you know, like, those blue gel packs that you probably have in your freezer. It seems like everybody has one of those. It's basically those fit within, like, a piece of clothing that you can just wear. So, for example, me and Tyson could be wearing them right now while we're doing this podcast. So it's a way to get cold exposure while you're doing something else. Or you could be watching TV and just getting that cold exposure. You could be wearing them at work.
Yeah.
So that's just one, like, super lazy way to get it in. Another way is just being cold in general. We talked about a lot of it. It was just these people were just sitting in a room getting the benefits.
Yeah, 60 degrees.
One thing that I do, it hasn't been cold enough yet for me to really be getting the benefits of it. But once it starts dropping down in the 40s, low 50s, stuff like that, during wintertime when I walk my dogs, I'm walking in shorts and a tank top. And part of that is just being that cold exposure. Another benefit to that is I'm just trying to get as much sunlight as possible, which you always need to do during wintertime because there's just less and less sun available. So that's just like another way is just wear little clothes and just be cold.
Yeah, that's actually a great tip. There's a lot of people out there. I don't walk dogs personally, but I know a lot of people do. Like, when the weather's cold, don't put on a damn beanie and gloves and six layers of socks and be comfortable. I mean, I'm not saying go out there naked, but put on a normal, you know, t-shirt, shorts, and go out there and feel that cold and get through it. It's hard, and that's a good thing. It's going to make you better. Like, don't be soft. Everyone's so soft, you know?
And if you want to know what cold is, you don't need to go to the point where you're, like, teeth are clattering, like, you're just sitting
there. You got ice from your nose.
You look like you're having a seizure because you're just shivering so much. Like, you don't need to be that far, but at least get some, like, goosebumps on your arms. Like, that's my marker. It's like, do I have goosebumps? Okay, it's cold enough. Good. If I'm not getting goosebumps, then I'm not cold.
Yeah. That's a great... I think a lot of people can do that.
Yeah, so I think that's...
Will they do it? I don't know, but they should do
it. Well, I mean, hey, the ice vest is, like, the easy way. If you don't want to take a cold shower... Honestly, the hardest part of the cold shower is turning that water to cold. It's not actually sitting in it. It's just like that first, like, am I going to do this? Am I going to do it? All right.
Yes. Yeah.
And then as soon as you do it, it's cold for like a few seconds and then you just
kind of... You get used to it.
Yeah.
You do. You get used to it. And yeah, that's one of the things. Like every morning I wake up, you know, I kind of set in like little tests. Like if you're going to pass or fail, right? And the first test is always for me, am I going to wake up and train? And for me, that's an easy test because I love that shit. But after I'm done training... So my shower is, like, constantly just on cold, right? Because is my wife, does she have a choice? She sure as shit doesn't, right? It's going to be on cold. And I hop in the shower, and the first thing that happens, that cold water, you feel it kind of hit your feet, like your calves. And guess what, bro? Your body's like, don't do it. This is the enemy. Don't do it. But you have to pass that test. And what you do, you step into that shit. And then you do your thing. You know what I mean? You pass that test. And then you get out of that shower with a little bit of pride knowing you passed the test. And I know it's not a big deal. I know it's just a damn shower. But there's so many people who go through their entire day without passing any sort of test. And I think that's a real problem.
No, yeah, that's a great tip. Because a lot of like self-help books, one of the first things that they'll recommend is you make your bed every day. And it has nothing to do with like making your bed every day.
The test.
It's just, yeah, giving you that little self of accomplishment. Something that you can do every single day. That, yeah, you pass the test first thing in the morning.
Yes, and I love it.
Just success builds on success, and it just kind of starts from there.
Exactly, yeah. Well, boom, that's the podcast done. Thank you for checking it out. You can find us at TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. We're on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff. Feel free to reach out anytime.
Yeah, please, if you like this podcast, share it with a friend. You can also rate and review on any of your favorite podcast providers as Apple Podcasts, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and YouTube. And there's also a donate button on our homepage. That's TNTWellnessAndNutrition.com. Please feel free to help us in any way you can. I hope everybody has a happy and healthy week.